Hello and a warm welcome to the Mission Shunya podcast. So, first things first, wherever you are at this point in time, hope you are taking the required precautions to keep yourself and your family safe amidst the COVID-19 pandemic outbreak. Countries and businesses are slowly opening up in phases around the world post the lockdowns. We are never really out of the problem yet, but we are bracing up for the new norm. Talking of the new norm, wouldn't it feel really better if you can continue to breathe the same fresh air that you experienced during the lockdown? All around the world over the last few months, we did see photographs, posts, and videos of how nature has reclaimed its territory. The air quality was good, the rivers were clear, the biodiversity was clearly visible all around. On this episode, we'll pick up the topic of air quality, and particularly in India. India has a few cities with poor air quality, but in the recent lockdown, it definitely got better. So, how did India perform during the lockdown in terms of the air quality, and what are the lessons learnt that can be implemented in the post-COVID era? As usual, we have an expert to discuss the topic in detail. So, who's my guest and what is her background?
Hi, I'm Tanushree Ganguly. I'm a researcher at the Council on Energy, Environment and Water, which is among Asia's leading policy research institutions. We are based in New Delhi, and I work on understanding the data gaps, which can help solve the air pollution crisis in the country. And also, I'm currently working on finding ways in which the air quality management process in the country can be improved.
Tanushree, let's begin by looking at Council for Energy, Environment and Water's work in air quality. We've had a discussion earlier also, sometime in the last year, about your work in air quality domain. So how has the journey been so far?
It's been a very interesting journey. Probably this came up in the conversation last time as well, but I'd like to briefly touch upon this small history of CEW's air quality work. So it started off with an independent evaluation of the first phase of the Odd Even scheme launched by the Delhi government in 2015. So we independently evaluated whether there were any considerable changes in air quality at 5 of the most populous intersections in Delhi. So that was the first piece of work back in 2015. In 2017, we started realizing that the conversation about impacts of crop residue burning on air quality is confined only to Delhi or, you know, urban cities, Indo-Gangetic plain. That was largely the narrative. So we wanted to try and understand how crop residue burning actually affects the people who reside closer to the fields, which is the farmers or people living in the villages where crop burning was actually happening. And in an urge to understand this better, we deployed 48, close to 50 sensors in Punjab just to see how badly rural air quality is affected. And we also wanted to communicate to the farmers that, you know, you might not realize, but this is affecting your health as well. So, and simultaneously, we also wanted to understand that what farmers are doing to sort of mitigate the effect of crop residue burning. And at that point in time, there was the government scheme, which was subsidizing the uptake of mechanized equipment like happy seeders for harvesting of crops. So we wanted to evaluate the economic benefit of using a happy seeder. So those were the two parallel studies that we carried out. One was trying to understand the impact of crop residue burning on rural air quality in Punjab, and the other was trying to sort of calculate the economics of the different alternatives available to the farmers to harvest their crop. From there, from understanding rural air quality, we started looking at the National Clean Air Program, which was launched earlier in 2019. So there was a draft which was circulated back in 2018, in April 2018, but the final document was launched in 2019, January 2019. So under the National Clean Air Program, there are various components to it, but one of the primary components is preparation of city action plans by the 100 plus non-attainment cities. When I say non-attainment cities, I mean the cities which have been identified by the Central Pollution Control Board, the cities which violate the National Ambient Air Quality Standards. So what we did is we looked at this point in time, 102 of these plans are available on Central Pollution Control Board's public portal. We looked at these plans to understand that what are the shortcomings in these plans which could potentially delay implementation. So this is an ongoing work. We have some very interesting results coming out of this study. So just to wrap up our history of working in air quality space, it started off with an independent evaluation of a policy measure, which was one of a kind at that point in time, the odd even, to understanding the impact of crop residue burning, which is villain number one for worsening air quality during endogastric flames. That was the narrative. So we try to understand what is the impact of crop residue burning in rural air quality, where it's actually happening near the source, to trying to understand what is the larger national policy and what is the course larger national policy on air quality management in the country is going to take. So yes, that's been our work. And if you also want me to touch upon what we are planning to do in the future, we are very keen on understanding hyperlocal sources. By hyperlocal sources, I mean mapping out those small dispersed area sources within cities, which remain hidden or which authorities probably don't pay much attention to, but are contributing to worsening pollution levels. So that's been the work at CEW and a lot of exciting work coming up in the future.
I must admit that ever since the last time I spoke to CEW, I mean, there's a lot of progress. And talking of hyperlocal issues kind of leads me to the main topic of discussion for today. India had this lockdown, 40-day lockdown, and it's been an extended lockdown in some parts as well. And of course, when industries shut down, when traffic is not there on the roads, pollution levels kind of drop down. So at the top level, how did India perform during this lockdown?
So like you rightly pointed out, reduction in activity levels is going to translate into reduction in emissions and ambient concentrations. So our understanding, our assessment, and you know, this also aligns with the assessment which have been carried out by various agencies, be it the Central Pollution Control Board, who've done an evaluation of the impact of the lockdown on air quality, or be it other research institutions who are also looking into it, is that there has been a decline in particulate concentration amounting to 30 to 50% across the country. So in some places, depending upon the sources and the meteorology, it's been higher on the higher side, which is 50 to 60%. In some places, again, depending upon the sources and meteorology, it's been on the lower side, which is 20 to 30%. But across the board, there has been a significant decline in both particulate matter and NOx levels, nitrogen oxide, nitrogen dioxide. In terms of sources, transport sector contributes largely to nitrogen dioxide and particulate matter, because the nitrogen dioxide which gets emitted into the atmosphere eventually results in formation of secondary particulate matter. So NOx has seen drastic falls, and because of this, PM2.5 levels has also reduced. The other thing which has come down is PM10. Now what happens is, there is a large, you know, the common narrative in the country, especially in the Indo-Gangetic plain, is that pollution that we see is actually dust. Now, true, there is dust. But what happens is that when vehicles pass through the roads, especially roads which are not well maintained or are not particularly very well paved, this dust, which is accumulated at the edges of the roads, it gets suspended in the atmosphere, contributing to particulate pollution. But because of reduction in vehicular movement, this PM10 component, which is basically dust, has also gone down. So we're seeing that with respect to pollutants, there has been a decline in PM2.5, NOx, and PM10 as well. So while PM2.5, I would say between 30 to 50%, with respect to NOx levels, there has been declines as large as 70% in areas. And of course, PM10 has also declined because of the reduction in dust suspension that happens. But this is barring an episode which happened in early April, where there was some dust inflow from west, which increased the PM10 levels. So PM10, because of movement of vehicles, the road resuspension has definitely gone down. But there was an external influx, you know, in early April, which contributed to some increase in PM10. But other than that, during the lockdown as such, we've seen how clean skies could look like. I mean, you know, from urban centers, you can see the Himalayan mountain ranges. So that bears testimony to the fact that because of clearing of the air, our visibility has significantly improved.
That's a good stat, Tanushree, to get an overall picture, the big picture. 30-50% drop in particulate matter is kind of a big number. I mean, on an average, if that is an average, I'm sure like some regions would have definitely performed better.
Right.
And I also like the idea or the availability of data, because you were able to kind of split between this is the level of PM2.5, this is the level of PM10, and the reasoning behind why certain categories have increased and certain categories have declined. I'm sure there have been other data sources as well. Different industrial activity kind of was running. Like, for example, it was towards the end of an harvest season and some regions kind of were still, agricultural activity was still continuing in that region. And some industries happened to be like essential services, so they were also functioning. Do you have access to that kind of data, looking at the finer details and saying like, okay, some industries contribute more to the overall pollution in general sense? Do you have access to that kind of data? Or?
Right. So this is a very important question that you raised, Girish. So the data availability in the country is not good. I mean, that's one thing which I can say without a doubt that it's not good. Because in India, there are 0.14 monitors per million people compared to an average of 3 in the United States or China or to Europe. So we have a long way to go when it comes to monitoring. What I mean by 0.4 monitors per million person is that in India, if we talk about the continuous ambient air quality monitoring stations, I'm not talking about the manual monitoring stations, I'm only talking about the continuous ambient air quality monitoring stations. There are approximately 200 operating in the country today. We have over 1.3 billion people and we have only 200 continuous monitoring stations. So to be very honest, drawing inferences on decline or improvement in pollution levels is subject to the kind of data that we have. Barring Delhi, which has 38 monitors, which are reasonably representative of the different kinds of land use within Delhi, the inferences drawn from the for the other cities are actually questionable. Let's talk about Lucknow. You know, Lucknow has almost similar pollution levels compared to Delhi. But guess how many monitors Lucknow has? 4. 5 now. There is one in Nishanganj. So from 38 to 4, that's the kind of, you know, imbalance in data availability that we have. And to respond to your question on industries, now, of course, there are continuous ambient air quality monitoring stations, which could be in industrial cities, right? But there is another set of monitoring that could happen in industries particularly, and this would be stack level emission monitoring using continuous emission monitoring systems. Now, all the red category industries, there are 17 categories of industries, let's say power plants, steel, cement industries, so on and so forth, which are supposed to have continuous emission monitoring systems. That's a mandate. Now, these units have these SEM systems, but we don't really have access to this information. If we were to have an access to this information, then we would be able to independently evaluate how emission levels have gone down. Now, this is interesting. So there are two different sets of measurements that I'm talking about, right? I'm talking about ambient concentrations, which is your PM2.5 and microgram per meter cube, and I'm talking about emissions from the stack. There are two different sets of concentrations. So while I could have an estimate, the PM2.5 in the air because of emissions from an industry could be a surrogate for saying whether emissions have gone down or not. But if I were to have access to the stack level data, I would very confidently be able to say that, yes, you know what? 50% of the emissions have gone down. So this imbalance, so we have data points for ambient concentrations, we don't have data points for stack measurements. It's important to understand the interplay between, you know, emissions and concentrations, because concentrations, again, are not entirely dependent on emissions. concentrations are also dependent on meteorological parameters like temperature, rainfall, relative humidity, your incoming radiations of the sun, wind direction. So, of course, I mean, the concentrations across regions have gone down, but this is also due to the fact that we've seen extremely favorable meteorological conditions during this period. So it's very crucial when we talk about monitoring, when we talk about inferences drawn on the data that we have, is to understand this interplay between meteorology, emissions, and concentrations, and finding those data gaps. And in this case, there are data gaps on the monitoring front in cities other than Delhi, like I mentioned, and of course in industrial cities, because the major source of pollution, industries, we don't have information to the pollution which is being created. But of course, we have information on the concentration. Does that answer your question?
Yeah, it answers my question to a large extent. But just one quick question before we move on. You did mention that there are only like 200 monitoring stations and...
Continuous monitoring stations.
Yeah, continuous monitoring stations, and nearly 38 of them are in Delhi. So as part of the National Clean Air, is there a plan to ramp up the number of monitoring stations, and why is there a delay in kind of ramping up the number of stations? Because I feel like the number of stations kind of was in the news for a long time. People said like we don't have data. But why do you see there is a lack in implementing or installing more stations to monitor data?
So the National Clean Air Program clearly says that, you know, we need to augment monitoring. So they say that the number of manual monitoring stations need to go up to 1,500, and the number of continuous monitoring stations need to go up to 700. And the time frame for the National Clean Air Program is still 2024. So it was launched as a five-year program. So the National Clean Air Program aspires to have 700 continuous monitoring stations in the country, of which we already have approximately 200 monitoring stations. Now, it's crucial to understand that the primary bottleneck in scaling up of continuous monitoring stations is that they're extremely expensive. So a continuous monitoring station could cost somewhere between 1.5 to 2 crores. You know, adding to that, you need to have a dedicated team which is constantly looking at the data which is getting generated by the continuous monitoring station. So there has to be a team which is analyzing the data and doing the QA/QC before it is sort of going to the portal where, you know, researchers like us can access this data. So in my opinion, the cost is definitely the primary bottleneck. And the second, of course, is, you know, also getting the people who can actually translate the data and put it out in a way that people can understand. So I think this can be attributed to both these things. And again, on the economics of it, when the NCAP, the National Clean Air Program, was launched in 2019, 28 priority cities were identified, which were given some amount of money based on their, you know, population levels. Like there were cities which got 10 crores, there were cities which got 5 crores, and this gradation happened on the basis of population. They were given this money to sort of kickstart on the implementation of activities. And one of the major things that cities did was acquire continuous air quality monitoring stations. So over the course of 2019 to 2020, cities have added one or two continuous monitoring stations, but it's still not adequate. And hopefully by the end of 2024, we'll be able to evaluate that between beginning of 2019 and end of 2024, to what extent the continuous monitoring capability of the country has expanded. The other thing that I just want to touch upon is that continuous monitoring station is still primarily confined to urban centers. We need to expand to rural areas as well. There is a very limited rural air quality monitoring happening. Again, the National Clean Air Program says that there has to be a rural air quality monitoring plan in place, but not much has happened on that front.
On similar lines, does that correlate to the fact that, say, analyzing the pollution levels at tier 2 cities where industries are kind of not monitored? So does that correlate to the fact that there is no accurate data on what kind of industries are operating and what is their impact in the general pollution trends as well?
No, that is absolutely correct. I mean, of course, there is a sense that there are certain industrial clusters operating in cities or in the outskirts of the city. And when I say outskirts, a cluster could be, let's say, 20 kilometers or 30 kilometers from the city and could still have potential worsening impacts on the city's air quality. So we know there is a cluster, but if you don't have a sense of the kind of units which are operating in the cluster, number of those units operating in the cluster, the output of those units, it is very difficult to assess what is actually the quantum of emissions which is coming from these clusters as such. So, you know, I mean, if there is a thermal power plant, we know that, okay, this thermal power plant generates XX megawatts of energy. It has five stacks. It has three boiler units. You know, you can estimate emissions from that industry. But this rule of, you know, having these surrogates in place for calculating emissions, which in this case was boilers, number of stacks, or the power output, cannot be translated to an industrial cluster where we don't know the number of units, what the industrial units are producing, and you know, how much fuel they're using. So yes, this is crucial to map out the kind of industries which exist in these industrial clusters.
That is very unfortunate, actually, because, I mean, if we had data, we could have probably used this kind of lockdown period to kind of isolate the industries and kind of identify the root cause and identify the sources of pollution and kind of have some measures in place to kind of ensure that post-lockdown, there is a better monitoring to see how the industries can get better in pollution control.
Just to add to your industry's question, so, of course, I mean, what I wanted to convey is that there might be absence of granular information, but states, what they typically do is they put out these reports which summarize the general kind of industries which exist, you know, at least on paper, what kind of industries exist in an area. So I wanted to sort of highlight this quick analysis that I did. And of course, the data source is Urban Emissions. They put out a beautiful, you know, moving image on how air quality has changed across cities pre and post lockdown. So I took up a few industrial clusters because I wanted to understand how essential versus non-essential industries contribute to changes in pollution levels. You know, if you look at something like a Bhiwani, which is in Rajasthan, NOx concentrations have reduced by 70%, right? And largely, the kind of industrial operations which happen in Bhiwani includes auto component manufacturing, metal works, so which fall under the non-essential category. So 70% decline in NOx level. Now let's move to something like a Singrauli, where we have an ultra mega power plant project, or something like a Panipat. You know, Panipat is very interesting because Panipat has textile units, but Panipat also has, you know, fertilizer units, it has a food processing unit, and it has a thermal power plant. So while textile is classified as non-essential, the fertilizer industry, the thermal power plant, and the food processing industry, they were classified as essential. So they were operating. And in Panipat, there was about a 20% decline only in NOx levels. So you see how in an industrial state, which is on paper, primarily dominated by non-essential industries, the decline in NOx levels has been steep compared to another industrial area, let's say Panipat, where there is a mix of essential and non-essential industries. This fall has not been as steep. So it is these surrogates which make these comparisons interesting, and also long-term planning interesting, because this can help us determine that, you know, if there is an industrial estate, which is, let's say, 20 to 25 kilometers from a densely populated residential city, then what is the combination of industries which should be permitted in that area? Should we have a mix of, what is the right balance of very polluting? Of course, you know, there have to be steel industries, there have to be power plants which need to mitigate their emissions. But still, from the planning points of view, what is the number of these units which should be permitted in an area without having a debilitating impact on the air quality in the nearby area?
That is really interesting. I'm sure like data points like this is kind of the interesting ones where there can actually be action items based out of this. Isolate, say, metropolis like more than 10 million people and say like industries can't operate in a so-and-so region or have only essential industries surrounding that place. So yeah, I mean, these are the kind of data points that the government has to take a deeper look and kind of have this in when they plan for setting up new industrial clusters going forward?
So I think the point that I wanted to mention is that it's not about essential and non-essential, to be honest, because, you know, nobody would want a lockdown to strike the economy again, where you're shutting down the non-essential and only keeping the essentials running. But it's more of a service industry versus manufacturing industry comparison. So what is that right balance to have? I mean, of course, you know, manufacturing has to happen in an emerging economy like ours, but we need to understand that if you're looking at it from the pollution point of view, what are those kind of activities? So what is the balance? So if I have multiple steel units around my city, then how many of those steel units need to be permitted? If, let's say, a steel industry asks for an expansion, should I permit the expansion? So for that, what's happened is, this is known as a capacity assessment. So if you have an industrial cluster, if you can set the limits on the amount of emissions this cluster could have, then you can, you know, back calculate and see that, okay, this should be the permitted number of units. If my number of units goes beyond this, then there could be a significant impact. So this capacity assessment of an industrial cluster needs to happen, because we have close to, you know, 100 polluted clusters in the country. Understanding what is the maximum emission limit of these clusters is particularly crucial to planning the future of these clusters.
Yes, I kind of like the way you put it. I mean, this is a better way to kind of have set a limit and look at industrial clusters based on the emission targets and emission limits in each cluster. That's an interesting way to look at. I mean, that can be one of the recommendations that can go for post-lockdown and in general and for the long term. Now, Tanushree, shifting gears and looking at the other kind of data points that we had access to. One other data point that we had access to was what Google and Apple kind of released their own mobility reports.
Right.
What are the interesting findings from that report?
So these reports are extremely insightful, I have to admit. So I'll just also touch upon the data of this report. So the information on these reports largely comes from the data which is being fed by the cell phones which users have been using. Okay, so I mean, if your routing data is on, then this information gets captured, right? So if you look at Google estimates, and I'm talking about the national figures, so according to Google, recreational trips have gone down by over 70% in the country. Office trips, like, you know, trips to office, they've gone down by close to 50%, and to transit stations, close to 60%. So I mean, very evident that travel in the country has considerably reduced because, you know, we're all shut inside our houses. Apple has similar estimates. It talks about, you know, driving trips being down by close to 70% in India. So, I mean, the data points are very comparable, but they point to the fact that trips, travel in the country has significantly gone down. So for me, looking at the transit trips versus transit trips was interesting. So a lot of people probably use, you know, cab services, autos, or two-wheelers for the last mile connectivity, which is the 57% component that I'm talking about. So what that means is that people still are using different modes of transport for their last mile. So last mile connectivity could potentially be improved or could be moved to, let's say, public transport. Recreational trips have come down by 80%. And I would assume that most people use a combination of public transport or probably private transport for their recreational trips. So how is it that, you know, public transport can be augmented on routes which people frequently use for their recreational trips? So these are a few interesting insights which come out from the Google and Apple data, because the categorization of importance is also categorization of the different kinds of routes. So people probably take different routes for getting to their commercial areas, different routes for getting to their recreational destinations. So if we have this information now, it could very well help cities in planning their bus routes and their public transport routes as such.
Yeah, those are really interesting data points. At once, when I kind of looked at the numbers and like when I hear the numbers again, I feel like, okay, it's only 70-80%. That's still a good number. That means kind of it also validates that people kind of took trips only when it really mattered or was it when it was really essential. So that is a good data point to have. And Now, that kind of leads me to the next set of questions. Post-lockdown, when country kind of opens up industries, what is your opinion? Will we see people shunning public transport just to kind of have the distance or just to have their own private vehicles? Do you think that will happen, or what is the scenario like from countries that have opened up? Do you see public ridership has gone down?
So I think that this is my opinion. I think it'll take a while for public transport to get back, to full capacity, because people are going to be wary of traveling in a crowded bus or, being underground while, getting on a metro. It's going to be challenging for public transport. So, China has opened up public transport, and there are some interesting data points coming from China. So if you see, the modal share of metro has dropped from 26% to 14%. Bus ridership has gone down from 17% to 10%. So public transport options in China have actually gone down post opening up of the lockdown. On the contrary, bike sharing system, which is more, individualist, people typically get on a bike alone. Usage of bike services has gone up drastically. Unfortunately, India does not have as many, bike service options available. So it'll be very interesting to see how India commutes. Of course, there is going to be a considerable people who can afford to switch to private transport are probably going to switch to private transport. I don't know if ride hailing services ever going to come back. And even when ride hailing services are going to come back, when I say ride hailing services, I mean the likes of Uber and Ola. And even if they come back, will they still have the share option? Because a lot of people use an Uber share and Ola share to get to work. Or will it only be like a single person trip? So those are the interesting things we'll have to see, that, ride-hailing services might be back, but will the share services be back? Buses might be back, but will buses be back in full capacity? Or will there be more buses along the same route so that the ridership density can sort of be staggered? Because, people could be waiting at bus stops and they will want to force themselves into the bus, but ideally they shouldn't, because social distancing principles need to be in place. So To accommodate these people, the number of buses along the same route will have to be increased. So those are a few interesting things that could happen. But again, I think public transport will take some time to sort of get back, into full swing.
Again, it's an interesting scenario, because when people kind of shun public transport, the other thing that we should definitely take a look at is what will happen to the pollution numbers. Will we go back to pre-COVID times with the pollution numbers as we kind of open up the economy and allow people to go to office, go to recreational places? That's going to be a worrying factor, right? Even in China or any country, that could be a worrying factor, right?
Yeah, it's of course a worrying factor, but it's also something to ponder upon. There are cities which are, expanding now in the country. Like I keep going back to the example of Amravati, because it's a city which is being developed. So we can still think of how we want to plan that city, whether we want to take up the US model, which is largely, car centric, where people like to stay in the suburbs and come to the city to work, or whether we want to adopt a more European model where cities are planned around public transport. So for cities which are emerging now, which don't yet have formal public transport systems, it's very important to understand how we are planning for our mobility choices. We cannot be, a car-centric country. We cannot afford to be a private transport-centric country. We have to take cues from other countries. For example, London. What London is doing is that it's saying that we are going to have car-free zones in the country. No cars will be permitted. No personal vehicles will be permitted within the city center of London. These are the cues which we need to pick up. Paris is probably going to do something similar. A lot of cities across the country, world have resorted to something called tactical urbanism. But they're saying that, this is the time when we need to have our biking lanes in place so that people can bike, which is an eco-friendly mode of transport, and people can also maintain the social distancing principles. These are the lines in which we need to think, whether we want to be a car-centric country, whether we want to be the country which stays in the suburbs and comes to the city center, traveling for over 20-30 kilometers to get to work, thereby polluting on our way to work, or whether we want to be a country which believes in public transport. So those planning principles need to be thought through right now.
Yeah, I totally agree to that, because I mean, of all the things that COVID has done to the economy and the planet in general, it's kind of reset everyone's thinking. Even the governments at a big level have to think about what is more essential. I'm sure like a lot of, as you mentioned, a lot of European countries are kind of re-looking at their infrastructure plans. And I think UK again has this new transport plan that is released. Again, it emphasizes more on bicycle ridership, increasing the bicycle ridership. So these are the kind of measures that countries have to take if they have to ensure that the air quality is also maintained post-COVID. Sticking to the same theme, what can government do to maintain that the air quality that we witnessed during the COVID lockdown that stays, or people continue to breathe better air as we transition to post-COVID times?
I mean, as unfortunate as the lockdown is, but it also came at a very apt time. I'll tell you why. Because, you know, I'm pretty sure you're aware that the union budget announced 4,400 crores for mitigating air pollution in the million plus cities across India. Now, these funds are contingent upon whether these cities have a plan to cut down emission levels or not, which is the City Action Plan. And as we discussed earlier in this conversation, in response to the National Clean Air Program, 102 cities put together these plans. Now, what needs to happen is that cities very clearly need to identify their short-term, medium-term, and long-term goals. Because, again, going back to this 4,400 crores for million-plus cities, one part of it is going to go to the cities. Let's say it was going to go out in May 2020. It's probably going to get delayed and go out in June or July 2020. And the second part is subject to performance of the cities, right? So cities very critically need to identify that between 2020 and 2021, what are those things that they need to do, which is definitely going to have a significant impact on cutting down emissions. Now, I were to decide, I would definitely spend on increased monitoring. There has to be more monitoring in the country. We need more representative data. And when that kind of fund is coming into the city, cities need to prioritize monitoring. Lucknow cannot operate with just 4 monitoring stations and have air quality as bad as in Delhi. So improve monitoring. Number 2, increased inspections. This could mean hiring more people or training the existing set of people in pollution control boards or municipal corporations to increase the frequency of inspection in areas which consistently pollute. And this brings me to the kind of analysis that we are trying to do in cities. I mean, we at our level deployed field resources right before the lockdown in Lucknow to understand what is the spatial distribution of polluting sources in Lucknow. Of course, we don't have the monitoring information, but while the continuous monitoring systems get installed, what we can do is we can visually map out the pollution activities in area. Which are the areas where waste burning happens rampantly? Which are the areas where there are auto component shops which end up burning a lot of tires? You know, rubber gets burnt, metal components get burnt, pollutions increase. Which are the areas where there are, you know, hundreds of food stalls which are still using coal for cooking food? Because, you know, I mean, I know for sure that Calcutta has thousands of those stores which use coal or dirty fuel, solid fuel for making food. So mapping out these dispersed sources, and India has a wide variety of pollutant sources. So mapping out these sources is crucial while we get more monitoring in place. Number 3 is if the government chooses to support industries to help them recover economically, then in the long run, there has to be conditionality. When I say conditionality, the industries need to meet certain emission criteria. Now, if you look at, you know, how the power plant emission standards have panned out, I mean, we have been delaying meeting of emission standards for power plants for years now. And, you know, we can't be doing that because the air quality in India, across the country, and not just Indo-Gangetic Plain. I just wanted to emphasize on that because the narrative largely is that it's only the Indo-Gangetic Plain which is polluted. But more than 80% of India's population breathes air which is non-compliant with national ambient air quality standards. which is higher than the WHO standards, by the way. So we cannot delay meeting of emission standards. So if there has to be a three-step process towards achieving improved air quality, my three-point action would be that: monitoring, inspection, and conditional bailouts.
Those are really interesting points. I particularly like the point number three, conditional bailouts, because they have been in lockdown for a couple of months and the entire economic activity around the industry, the entire value chains, the links have been broken at multiple levels. And when there is a reboot, economic reboot, I think government can think about it in a bigger picture, have some strings attached before they do any bailout or provide any financial assistance to industries, then they could have some strings attached and ensure that air quality is also preserved in the long run.
Yeah, I just wanted to come in here. I mean, the conditional bailout point is also very tricky because it needs assessment from the pollution control boards. So if you closely look at the three points that I've mentioned, they are very closely interlinked. You have to monitor better to understand emissions better. You have to compute the emissions if you were to set emission limits. And your conditional bailout and this conditionality will depend on the first two things. So in the absence of the first two, the third cannot happen because then the conditionality will be arbitrary. And that's the last thing we want. The conditionality has to have a scientific basis to it. So these three things are extremely interdependent on each other and have to happen simultaneously or in a staged manner is what I meant.
I mean, I totally understand that point because there's a general saying, right? If you can't measure something, then you can't better or you can't improve on that.
Touché, absolutely.
Measuring the data, getting the right source of data is really essential. Tanushree, it's been an absolute pleasure kind of getting to know more about the air quality during lockdown and what can we expect once the lockdown is lifted and once industries start functioning. A lot of good suggestions and a lot of good things that we can probably take forward in future discussions. So thanks for taking time and sharing your views on the podcast.
Thank you for speaking with me, Girish. It's been an amazing conversation. And I hope that some of these recommendations that we discussed during the course of this conversation do get implemented at some point in time. Thank you so much for having me on the podcast.
The three-point action item towards the end was a perfect way to sum up the situation in India. And it also gives us an opportunity to plan ahead for the post-COVID era. Once again, point number one, improve the number of monitoring stations. Number two, improve the inspection and capacity building activities, like mapping out the sources to pollutants in places wherever possible. And three, bailouts to industries and corporations with strings attached. It's a complex issue, but it is something that the government can think of seriously. The third suggestion is something similar to one we got from Vish Iyer, our guest from episode 30, discussing the clean tech sector in post-COVID-19. So in case you haven't checked that or any of the other episodes, please do check the archives on any platform for Apple and Android devices. Also, the entire playlist is available on the Mission Chunia website, missionchunia.com. Now on to this week's action item towards Mission Chunia. Well, for most part of the discussion, as you would have observed, Tanushree had some good recommendations for all the relevant stakeholders to improve the air quality. But towards the end, I did pose a question. How can we, you and I, take the lessons from the lockdown to ensure we do our bit to breathe some clean air? And this is what she had to say.
So, you know what? I mean, I would like to quote this book that I've been reading. And this is also a book recommendation for everybody who tunes into this podcast. It's a book by Dan Spears. It's called Air, Pollution, Climate Change, For the Same Pretense. There's this line in the book that says that morality cannot solve air pollution. Okay, so let's get that straight. If I am conscious of my lifestyle choices, I can contribute to a bit, but it cannot solve for the larger systemic changes that are needed to solve for air pollution. Of course, I mean, it's not one step that people can do, but it's you know, multiple steps that people can do. One is, of course, garbage, okay? This was an absolutely amazing opportunity for people to start segregating waste at home. You know, just being conscious of the fact that you're not stepping out of your house, but there is a garbage collector who's coming at your doorstep to collect your waste every day. The least you can do is that, you know, reduce the amount of waste that you're handing over to him. This was an absolutely amazing time. People should have started segregating and composting at home. I mean, I'll tell you how it helps logistically also. you can keep putting, you know, if you have only dry waste, which you are planning to dispose, then you can put out your dry waste, let's say, twice in a week. But if you are storing wet waste in the house, which you intend to dispose, then you have to dispose it on a daily basis. Instead of that, what you can do is you can segregate your dry and wet waste, take your wet waste, compost it, and then you can dispose of your dry waste twice a week. So logistically, it helps. Number two, transport choices. I mean, as much as I would want people to use public transport, I know it's not going to happen because people are going to be wary of traveling in crowded spaces. But eventually, once, you know, when things seem to be in control, which I don't know when, people should be conscious of the choices that they are making with respect to transport. And, you know, even offices could help people. I mean, I think work from home has worked out reasonably well for most people. So if offices could, you know, have one day or maybe 2 days in a week where people could work from home, it could reduce commute trips. That could be a way in which people and, you know, commercial establishments could help promoting telecommuting, thereby reducing travel emissions. Number three, people need to be vigilant. What I feel is that there are pollution control helplines. At least some pollution control boards have put together pollution control helplines for people to report any grievous violations that they see. So people need to be vigilant. If you are saying that there is an industry which is constantly emitting black smoke into the atmosphere, you should take a picture, reach out to the pollution control board, reach out to the city authority, let them know that this is happening. I mean, we say that, you know, the city authority or the pollution control board is not doing enough, but there has to be some amount of sustained engagement from people as well. That's number three. And finally, there's something that I want to talk about, which people have not been talking about much, but I personally feel it's important. It's your indoor air quality. I mean, we typically attribute poor indoor air quality to rural areas where people still use solid fuel for cooking. But while it's absolutely true, we also need to be conscious about the fact that, you know, we're going to end up spending more time indoors. So it's very important to ventilate your house because, you know, there will be some amount of dust settling on your floor. Ventilate it, let fresh air come into, and especially the air outside is fresh. So let some fresh air come into your rooms. While you're cooking, if you have a chimney, please switch on the chimney or please switch on the exhaust so that the cooking fumes don't get trapped in your kitchen. That needs to flow out as well. So largely, I think when it comes to people, it's not just one step which people can do, but it's a combination of steps which people can adopt with respect to waste, with respect to transport, with respect to being vigilant towards polluting activities, and finally taking care of their indoor air qualities. So yeah, that's what people could do.
So you can connect with Tanushree on Twitter or LinkedIn. The links are in the show notes section of the podcast. Also, you can find out more about the work done by CEW by visiting their website, that is www.cew.in. You should also check episode 16 of the podcast featuring a conversation with Karthik Ganesan, another expert in the space. In fact, Karthik also hosts a podcast called The Peak Planet, which might be of interest to you. The details are in the website www.cew.in. So hope you enjoyed the last three episodes with COVID-19 as a central theme. 2 weeks from now, we will be back with another episode, so make sure you subscribe to the podcast. And if you have been following Mission Shunya, why not spread the word? It just takes 30 seconds to share the podcast to 3 people in your network. So please consider doing that. So with that, signing off, this is Girish Shivakumar and thank you for listening.